And while you discuss the foundation of probability theory itself, because it's quite a perennial debate that's been going on for hundreds of years, so why discuss it now? I mean, there's been no clear winner in hundreds of years. So, but what I want to argue here is that the only way anyone's going to win the argument as to what is probability, it's going to be through physics. We're going to have to work out what probability theory is consistent with the physics that we end up invoking. And there are a couple of different options that we can use. We can use Bayesian probabilities, we can use relative frequencies, and we can use what's called propensities. Propensity is quite an interesting one because they're always calculated via either relative frequencies or via Bayesian probabilities, and then you just claim them to be ontological in some sense. So I'm not really going to use them because any problems that you have with relative frequencies or Bayesian probabilities, they're going to just be carried through. Just claiming that they're ontological isn't going to change anything, so let's just not really discuss them. And it turns out that if you, with Bell's inequalities and with Bell's theory, if you do assume that they are ontological in some sense, there might be issues with non-locality and irrationality and stuff. So I'm not going to discuss propensities. But what about relative frequencies? You give them some kind of reality, some kind of... So the dice have a probability, so it's not something that we assign to it, or that it has by its nature of throwing it again and again and again infinitely. And the other option is relative frequencies. But there are a variety of reasons why these are problematic to an extent. Well, first of all, if I keep throwing dice again and again and again, it's going to decay. And it might decay in quite erroneous ways, like the symmetry of the dice might change as I throw. So it's not really clear whether we'd be introducing any factitious problems by using an infinite ensemble. I mean, clearly dice are quite robust, so that's not necessarily a problem with dice, but if we begin to start to discuss quantum mechanics, such robustness might, unknown robustness might cause problems. And also in modern physics, we try to do things in a background independent way. So I can't really think of any way that you can define a relative frequency in a background independent way, because you're always going to be discussing things relative to a lab. Like if I'm throwing a dice, I probably define trials to be independent and other such things. So there's also a pragmatic reason why I don't want to use relative frequencies, and that's that I can always end up getting them from a Bayesian assignment. I can have a Bayesian assignment of probability, and I can introduce further assumptions about the exchangeability of infinite sequences, and then I can get relative frequencies out. So pragmatically, I may as well discuss Bayesian probabilities, because I can always get relative frequencies in certain situations if I need them, and I can use propensities if I really want to, but that's not going to change the issue at the moment. So, for the rest of the talk, I'm basically going to be discussing Bayesian probabilities. And they were formalized in the 1950s, 1940s by Cox. He gave a set of axioms for Bayesian probabilities. And so, we basically start out quite simply with a Boolean algebra. So we're going to have propositions alpha, beta, and gamma, say, can name them all, and then we're also going to have logical connectors between them, so and or not, and these are just the normal ones that you get by Venn diagram and so on. You can also assume a hypothesis I, say, if I'm throwing a dice, the hypothesis might be that the dice is there, for example. Then I want to assign probabilities to these, and I want to give a reason why I'm going to assign them in a certain way. And obviously, we want probability to be a transitive notion of preference. If one proposition is going to be more probable than another, and that proposition is going to be more probable than another, we want the first one to be more probable than the last one. That's just what we mean by a probability. We want it to be a notion of preference in some sense, so it has to be transitive. There is also this notion of universal comparability. Some have claimed that what we want from probability is that for all pairs of propositions in our proposition space, we want their probabilities to be comparable in some sense. We want them either to be larger than each other, smaller than each other, or equal to each other. And this is a slightly dubious axiom. There's a there's a history of trying to reject it, because there's no economic reason why we should choose to do that. But clearly, if we do choose to use these, what I'm calling zero axioms here, 0a and 0b, and if we do choose to use both of them, then clearly we can use real numbers for probabilities, because there's a total order in the space, and it's really made transitive assignments. So it's quite natural for us to use real numbers in that case. And if we do choose to use real numbers, and what Cox showed was that he can derive the behavior of probabilities using these two criteria of rationality. And they're basically axioms about how you should assign probabilities. And they can be quite hard to explain, but basically, let's take the second one first. If we try and assign a probability to a negation, we don't want it to functionally depend on anything more than the probability of the proposition prior to its negation. And that's simply because if we were to assume it was more than functionally dependent on that, we'd be introducing factitious relations in our probability theory that wouldn't be mirrored by the relations in the underlying algebra. So that's basically why we assume this. And similarly with Cox's first axiom, that's about how the AND operation in the Boolean case behaves. So if we assign a probability to alpha and beta, then we want it to only functionally depend on these two probabilities, simply because otherwise we'd be introducing relations between probabilities that we have no rational justification for doing so. That's why I call them the criteria of rationality. And from these axioms, we can prove quite a lot of things.
I'm sort of puzzled about what the actual starting point is here.
Yeah.
Because if you assume these p's are real numbers, then obviously not a and not b are automatically true.
Yes.
They don't really need to be stated as assumptions.
Sure.
But if the p's are not real numbers, then what are we assuming they could be? And what, for example, would a greater than sign even mean in the axiom?
Okay, so what we're going to get to is basically what Cox assumed is he assumed real numbers. He didn't really discuss these. He assumed real numbers and discussed these and worked out how probabilistic they behave. But it turns out we're going to be discussing a generalization that isn't going to be using the real numbers. And so that's why I've introduced these, just because I'm going to end up denying them. And so we're going to get a generalization. So it's not going to be real in the end. But I don't want to preempt myself. So what can we prove from these axioms of probability? We can prove all the natural things that we think every day about axioms of probabilities. We can prove that they're going to be bounded in some sense, so we can always arbitrarily put them in 0, 1 if they're real numbers. So this functional dependence between the probability of a negation and this non-negation, this just becomes true. And similarly, because the AND operation in Boolean logic is associative, we can prove Bayes' rule, and that's something that people in probability theory use every day. We can also prove how the OR operation behaves. Because remember, we had two axioms about, we had one about the AND and we had one about the negation operation. And that turns out to be sufficient to tell us how the OR operation behaves with additional propositions. And in such a case, it needs to be additive. And that's what you can prove from these axioms. That's what Cox proved in the 50s. But obviously, they don't give us a way to assign a unique number to all these propositions. So we need to work out a way to do that. And what people tend to use is quite waffly statements about the principle of insufficient reason, like Frame and Dice. Because my hypothesis is that it's fair, I should assign equal probabilities. So that's one way to try and define assign a unique number to each of these propositions. And the principle of insufficient reason is a criteria of rationality in the same sense that Cox's axioms were. And I'm going to argue later on that there might be relations, might be a relation between Bayesianism and relationalism, but. I'm also preempting myself there as well, so let me move on. So what's the situation in quantum theory? Obviously, our proposition space is going to be slightly different. We're going to have a set of projection operators, and we've got some natural logical connectives to find on them that are quite analogous to the and, the or, and the engagement operation. And one of course is presume a hypothesis. I'm just going to keep the hypothesis implementation just because that's what you do at Bayesian probability, so I'm not really going to discuss it. Obviously, there's problems with these logical connectives because they're not distributive and stuff like that, but we're going to take quite a naive approach and just see, well, let's just apply Cox's axioms in a quite naive way. We'll see what we get. And so if we want probability assignments to be in a standard manner, just in 0, 1, additive disjoint probabilities and so on, then we can derive Gleason's there. So if we just simply assume that they're of that form, we can assume that they must be of this form, which is where the trace of the projection operator times a density matrix. So we can prove that probability assignments are in one-to-one correspondence with density matrices. So that's why we have to discuss density matrices in quantum mechanics, which is quite interesting. So that's what Gleason theorem tells us. And we have an assumption about non-contextuality in that proof, and that's basically just that our probability assignments only depend on the proposition itself. They don't depend on what measurement you're discussing and stuff like that. So that's just an extra assumption that goes into the proof. But we get a problem in quantum theory, and that's why we're all here, because it's quite problematic to an extent. But I'd like to argue that most of the problems seem to arise when we discuss more than one proposition. Clearly, trace of P rho is completely uncontroversial. I mean, it's standard probability. It's additive and behaves Cox's axioms and so on. So we only get to problems when we're discussing more than one proposition. So we discuss one, probably multi-time propositions. So then we have to discuss wave function flaps, we have to discuss non-additivity, we have to discuss non-locality if we're discussing propositions that are space-like separated. So as soon as we discuss more than one proposition, we get into problems. So we can postulate probabilities for such cases, but then they become non-additive. So we have a little problem there as well, because Cox's axioms suggests that probabilities have to be additive. That's part of their very definition. So I want to try and be a bit quite honest about this and tackle it head on. So we're going to define a proposition space that consists of a series of single-time propositions. And then we're going to try and use Cox's axioms to derive a notion of probability rather than postulate it. We want to derive a notion. So this is what I mean by our kind of honest approach of doing it. So, but how are we going to define a series of propositions that are ordered in time? I'm going to follow Eichmann's work, which is where we define a history proposition that I'm calling alpha to be time-ordered series of projection operators that are tensor product together. And you might think, well, why am I tensing them together? It's a bit of an odd thing to do. But we don't have to do it. It just turns out that it's particularly convenient. I could put commas here and then try and define this proposition space and notions like and or and negation by that manner. But if I put tensor products here, clearly this thing here, this alpha, is itself a projection operator on a much larger Hilbert space. So then I get all the devices that I normally use in quantum theory. I can use the normal and or and negation operation that are admittedly slightly controversial, but I can still use them. I can use the formalism. So that's why I still use this. And I'm going to use it here. So we can discuss history propositions as projection operators in a much larger Hilbert space. We can find the AND operation, the OR operation, the negation operation. So it's going to be quite convenient. So then, in our naive approach, if we then apply Cox's axioms, what do we get? So if we take a history algebra, alpha gamma, we're going to call that the same name. We're going to have the standard logical connectives and or negation. We're also going to have another one. Because, of course, if we go from a proposition space that consists of propositions at single times to a proposition space that consists of whole histories of propositions, we have another logical relation between propositions in our space. That's namely changing the temporal order. And that's why it's called M. So M is changing the temporal order. So naively, if we then just apply the four axioms that I've given before, just repeated them here for our space, what do we get? And we come across a few problems. Firstly, we have this, we've introduced this time reversal operation, so we're going to need to discuss how we're going to deal with it. Because obviously, before we had two axioms, we had one about the and, one about negation, and that allowed us to prove stuff about the OR operation. But if we're introducing another one, we're going to have to introduce another notion of another axiom of analogous to Cox's first two. So let's just define what M means. M just acts on tensor products of vectors, and it just changes the order of them, and that's it. So in the Heisenberg picture, this would change both the kinematical and the dynamical order. So we need another axiom. But clearly, M behaves in a manner completely analogous to the negation operation. If I apply it twice, I get the same thing back. So again, doing our very naive approach, we just do something that's almost exactly the same as the negation axiom. So our probability to be assigned to the time reversal operator must only be functionally dependent on the probability of alpha.
They only just applying M once, even though you've written M twice. Because you're applying it from both sides.
Yeah, I'm applying it from both sides. That's just because I've defined it on vectors. So that's the only reason. So that's what I'm suggesting as a naive axiom to introduce for this space. And then also we have a problem of universal comparability, which goes back to the second slide. It seems to be against the very principles of quantum mechanics, in the sense that in quantum mechanics I have propositions that are incompatible in some sense, or complementary, or whatever words you want to use. They're problematic. So if I begin to assume a probability theory that manifestly compares the probabilities of such propositions, then I might be introducing factitious problems into our theory. So it's not clear whether we should assume it. And throughout the history of probability theory, people have been trying to deny it, because there's been no reason to assume it. So we're just going to deny it and see what happens. But of course, if we remove axiom theory, it's not clear whether we can or should use real numbers to represent probabilities. So what should we use? And in quantum mechanics, we often get lots of complex entities floating around. So the most natural to use is a complex number, I think. And that's what we're going to suggest here. So again, sorry, I'm repeating myself again, just for so we have all this. We've taken away zero, our axiom zero thing. We've introduced our new axiom, I'm calling freestar. And it turns out that there's a history in the literature for doing this, and that Youssef has proved that these two axioms, Cox's 1 and 2, are compatible with complex numbers. There's no equivalent reason why I can't apply these two axioms to complex numbers. And of course, as our transitivity and our introduced third axiom, they're compatible with complex numbers as well. Now, clearly, we have a problem because we need to identify which partial order we're going to use on the probability space. But there's no a priori reason to choose a particular one just yet. So we can plausibly use complex numbers as probabilities in this naive sense. But what in particular should we assign as probabilities? And in the literature, there's also a natural notion that people do, that has cropped up. They haven't identified it with probabilities, but it does appear in the literature. And this is just the trace of a class operator of our history times a density operator. So it's very close to what you normally use in quantum mechanics, but it's slightly different. I mean, it's a complex number. And you have an ordered series of projection operators. Instead of tensor producting them together, you just multiply them together. And it turns out that this.
So if you're allowing the full algebra and look for both of these history propositions, then you're going to end up with propositions which aren't writable in that form, right?
Of this form? If I use the full algebra as in,
So what are you going to...
This is for what I'm calling homogeneous. So if I just do it as a time ordered series, if I then start combining them in a manner, I might get out of this naive approach. But I'll end up arguing that I can find a generalization that will also be appropriate. I see your point. I mean, this is for so for ordered series of projection operators, this class operator is well defined, and it also behaves in quite natural ways. For example, if I do use the OR operation to get me to something else, some other history that isn't just an ordered series of projection operators, it turns out that this class operator definition defined in items where is additive. So this notion of probability, if they're disjoint, it's additive to disjoint histories. It also obeys Bayes' rule for commuting histories, and it also obeys our extra axiom free stuff. So it might naively think that we could use this. I mean, but no one's ever going to believe this unless you apply some kind of uniqueness proof or what have you, to try and show that if you just assume that probabilities behave in the manner that I suggested, that they must be of this form. And that's what we're going to try and prove in a moment. But just to give you a bit of context, I mean, people have often tried to introduce negative probabilities and probabilities that are larger than one. I mean, Feynman did so, and Hartle has discussed this quite a lot. But of course, they don't obey the axioms of probability according to a Bayesian account, anyway. So it's not clear why we should use them. I mean, there are closing reasons. I used to be convinced by Feynman's arguments, but clearly, since they don't obey Cox's axioms, it might be nicer to go to a different space entirely rather than the real numbers to try and assign a Bayesian assignment. And I'm not too worried, for example, that in experiments, obviously, we naively use relative frequencies, and that's what experimenters like to have. But I can derive relative frequencies from this object. If I take the real part and define a consistency condition, as in the history program, I'll get something that seems to behave like relative frequencies in the sense that they have stability properties in ensembles. So I'm not too worried about that. And of course, this entity here is exactly how you calculate the Berry phase in a more generalized format. So there are experimentally verifiable regularities that are contained in this entity, so it's quite a nice thing to have. So we have the linearly positive histories and the consistent histories formations, and they appear in suitable limits. If I take the real part, I can discuss consistency conditions and stuff, and get to these two theories that are in the literature. But of course, we're going to try and find an analog of Gleason state of these probabilities, because otherwise no one's ever going to believe them. So we want to find the analog of Gleason state. So clearly our axioms ensure that they're additive disjoint propositions, and we can say that they're normalized to some extent. The dubious one is this one at the top. We've got complex numbers, and you're going to need to try and define an axiom that discusses complex numbers a bit. And what I've done here is I've used my introduced verb axiom, and I've just stated that the complex number that we assign to m alpha m is just a complex conjugate. I mean, clearly this obeys our axioms. It's not clear that our axioms are Bayesian probability and ensure that we must make this assignment. So I'm taking it as a work and hypothesis at the moment, and we'll see what we get. Basically, it turns out there's an analog to Gleason's theorem that's actually appeared in the literature that I can just modify from my case. And this was originally done by Eichel, Linden, and Schreckenberg, but the decoherence functional, they found an analog of the Gleason's theorem for that. So they just made definitions of actions of what decoherence functional work and prove that they were in one-to-one correspondence with a certain form that's now just the Gleason's form. So this is what we're going to do here. We're going to assume that complex assignments of this form, so they're complex maps that are additive normalized in the basis conjugation property, and then we're going to prove that they must be of this form, where we have a trace now over of our big history space V, which is a Hilbert space, but much bigger than this page. So it's this here. And we're going to prove one-to-one correspondence between operators Y, which behave these properties. And so they're analogous to what you prove in Gleason's theorem about them being density matrices and stuff. So this is quite nice. We can prove this, and it's quite easy to do, so do this. Obviously, in one direction, it's trivial. If we assume that L is this of this form, then it obeys all these properties by the nature of these and the additivity of the trace. So we're sorted that way, but we've got to then prove that that assuming this, these three, means that we must necessarily get to this. And to do that, you can just use Gleason's proof. Because I can take the real part of my elements, and I can show that they're additive maps, for example, and I can show that they're bounded and stuff like that. So I can then assign a density matrix to such things. And similarly for the imaginary part, they're additive and bounded, so I can assign a density matrix to that. And I can construct this operator Y using such density matrices, and it works out, and that's the proof. Thank you much. And that's how I can effectively prove it and live in Schreckenberg, a dead analog of Gleason's theorem. So that's just basically a summary of what I just said. So we can prove that our complex assignments are in one-to-one correspondence with these operators Y. But we also need to argue something else, because if I go back, then this is slightly different to the form that we postulated. But it turns out that there are identities that can take me from the one that I postulated necessarily to this one. I can always put my postulated assignment into this form, which behaves these rules. So I'm not fully there yet in the sense that I haven't proved that my postulated assignment is in one-to-one correspondence. But I can prove that I can always put it in here, in this form, which then I can then prove is in one-to-one correspondence with complex assignments in this manner. So that's basically the program that I'm trying to do at the moment. So what does this mean in terms of how we do quantum theory? I'd argue that there are now three choices. From this perspective, there are three choices of using probability in quantum mechanics. You can do the standard way, which is to basically postulate probabilities, but that's problematic. We postulate them using wave function flaps, and then Gleason's theorem again. Then wave function flaps, then Gleason's theorem again. But then none of them. So they're slightly problematic. So it's a bit of an issue. And to try and get around this issue, what people have tried to do is use a consistent histories program, and that's a way of assigning an additive notion of probability. But then, because they're using real numbers, they can't do it to the whole space. They end up having to assign probabilities to sort of deconsistent sets of histories. So that's problematic as well, because you can't find the whole space. And similarly for the linearly positive histories program, that's analogous to the consistent histories, but a bit more general. So what I'm calling, I don't know what to call it really, but Bayesian histories, I guess, is good description. That's what we've been doing. And so there we're allowed any temporally ordered sequence of projection operators. And what you take the space of history propositions and you derive the notion of probability for in analogy with Gleason's theorem. I argue this is quite useful. I mean, you're deriving something, you're not postulating something. And it's additive and it behaves all the axioms. So at least it's a coding idea, I think. But it also incorporates the experimental basic quantum theory, whereas obviously relative frequencies and stuff don't. So by using Cox's axioms, we can actually combine the notion of relative frequencies, real phase improbabilities, and phase into one kind of complex entity that seems to behave in nice ways. So I'm going to take a slightly different tack now and just discuss a connection between this work and relationalism. I mentioned a brief connection at the beginning. So what is relationalism? Relationalism was arguably introduced by Leibniz, and he introduced two axioms or two principles about relational theories, and he suggested that you follow these two principles. Namely, the principle of sufficient reason, that every element of a theory should be rationally and physically justified, and the principle of identifying the indiscernible. If there's no way to discern two elements of a theory, then they should be identified. And this is a way of building a theory that doesn't introduce any factitious problems, in the sense that everything that you're doing is doing because you necessarily have to do it. So it's kind of like a theory building concept. But I'd like to argue that there is a very connection between relationalism and the Bayesian approach to probability. I mean, I've said down here that the Bayesianism is a relational theory of probability. That's quite a strong statement. I just like saying it because it's quite strong. But one can just look at it as an analogy. So in Bayesianism, we have the principle of insufficient reason. And we have Cox's axioms, and they're both criteria of rationality, just in exactly the same sense as these are criteria of rationality. So if you have no rational reason to assign different probabilities to two propositions, then you should identify their probabilities. And this is very similar in wording to the relational approach to physical theories. So again, this is a very strong statement that Bayesian is a relational theory of probability, and perhaps that's too strong. But I think there's a deep analogy there that I want to investigate. And clearly, this is useful for trying to justify using a Bayesian approach in quantum gravity or something, because then you'd have a relational approach of space-time and a relational approach of probability, and then clearly that can't be a bad fit. So that's kind of my what I want to get to in the end is this quantum gravity theory. And clearly what we've been doing is quite useful in the sense that what we've done is we've defined a proposition around where we can derive a probability from it. Okay? So clearly if we want to generalize, the easiest way is to change the proposition algebra. So if we want the quantum gravity theory, perhaps we can define a propositional algebra that is generally covariant or something like that, some other property that is relational in the proper sense of the word. So clearly this is an approach that I think is apt for generalization. This is basically a manifesto of what I've been doing. So presumably a quantum gravity theory will be a relational theory of space-time, and it will be a relational theory of probability. And hence I would argue that we should use Bayesian reasoning, and it's compatible with relationism. It might not be identified with relationism, but it's certainly compatible with it. But frequencies and propensities, I just can't see how they'd be so compatible. It allows us to derive, using a proposition from algebra, complex entities from simple pedagogical axioms. And it made it possible to define a generally covariant proposition from algebra. And then there is a thing, but this is just speculation. So, and I'd also argue that we should reject hierarchical comparability, because it seems to be this axiom, and it has always, in the history of probability theory, seems to be this axiom that always introduces factitious probabilistic causes in quantum theory. Things like non-locality, I mean. But again, I haven't given you a direct link between the two problems, but it's my gut feeling that it's this axiom of universal compatibility that is causing problems. So I think we might be able to bring locality back to quantum theory, as well as to gravitational theory, using these what I'm calling relational ideas. And of course, in the Bayesian approach, things are manifestly defined in respect to the observer. So we don't need to worry about the measurement problem. That just not even an issue in this approach. So, also relative frequencies are derivable. We've got a Berry phase that's derivable from these polar vertices that were introduced by Cox like 50 years ago, which is quite interesting. And the basic premise is basically that it's better to axiomatize quantum polar vertices rather than just claim them as non-additive primitive notions without any explanation at all. I mean, I just don't understand how polar vertices can be non-additive, so that's sort of the reason why I've done what I've done. So, we mentioned that there might be applications for quantum gravity. Let's try and discuss this a bit more explicitly. Because there are a variety of different propositional algebras that we could use. There's causal sets. There's Markovnikov's work in causal histories and acausal sets. Although she doesn't use the HPA space, so it's going to be quite a lot harder to find objects analogous to what we found in standard quantum theory. And there's also Hardy's recent causal work, which is a tentative framework that should accommodate both the relational theory of space-time and the theory of probability as well. So, I would argue that it might also be compatible with a relational approach to probability. We've also got Savage's work on persistent histories and generalizations, and she hasn't really discussed probabilistic notions yet. She's been mainly concentrating on defining the history proposition algebra and defining it to be generally covariant and so on. So I reckon this might be a way to try and get probabilistic predictions out of her work. And there's also work by Kastner that attempts to derive analogs of GR as a theory of inference, which is quite interesting, although it's quite naive. It's certainly an interesting approach, but I won't go into that. And also, another quite interesting thing is that we've defined a quite weird dubious notion of probability as a complex number. And there's no a priori reason why it should be compatible with the notion of entropy. But it turns out that it is, quite naturally. So if we just assume Shannon entropy, and if we assume so just sum over P log P, and we just put these as complex numbers, it turns out that it obeys Shannon's grouping property for entropy. Apart from the problem that you have to identify different branches of the logarithm. So what this property is, it's basically that if I write this entropy, if I split the probabilities into groups and assign the entropy of each group weighted by the probability of choosing that group, and then I add that to the entropy of necessarily choosing one of the groups, then I should get the same answer, and that's what is satisfied here. So it's quite interesting that we've naively introduced a complex notion of probability, but it's also compatible with the notion of entropy, namely Shannon's entropy. But Shannon's entropy also obeys other things other than the grouping property. It also obeys strong additivity and concavity. But Shannon derived his notion using just the grouping property. So it obeys the axiom that Shannon considered to be essential. And other identities like strong additivity or concavity, they're derived once you've calculated the form on the entropy. I mean, we can't yet prove that everything that obeys the grouping property for complex probabilities must be of this form. But clearly it's quite nice that it obeys Shannon's ideas. So that's an extra reason for thinking that this might be a plausible way of continuing. And that's it. I can see that it's not.
Why wouldn't that be?
Yeah, it's. I can see that it's. I can see what you're saying, that it's not necessarily that I use that M as a particular logical connector. It's not something that is as fixed as AND or an engagement. So, it was very naive.
You suggest a wider class of operations that we should consider in addition to AND.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite cyclical in the way I've been doing it. I used AND simply because I could then prove Gleason analog for it. So in that sense, I haven't justified it from a priori against, which is a bit unfortunate. But yes, I see what you're saying. There's not yet any a priori reason why I should use M in particular as an additional logical connector rather than something else. But it's clearly quite natural. I mean, if you're going from a single proposition to history propositions, clearly changing the temporal order is something that is a possibility. Quite natural. That isn't natural for the single time proposition space.
Okay, this is more of a general question about your philosophy. Why did you focus on Cox's particular axiom scheme? Because, I mean, if you know about the history of probability and statistics, it seems that, you know, there are almost as many methods for deriving probability as there have been statisticians in the world.
Yeah, sure.
What is it about Cox that, you know, you feel is more compelling than, say, the Dutch book kind of arguments or something else like that?
Yeah, I mean, I quite liked Cox's axioms just because they seem to me to be about not introducing factitious problems, and that then gave me kind of correlated with ideas in my head about Einstein's use of space-time coincidence and his very relational ideas. So that's sort of why I liked it. But I'm not a big fan of the Dutch book arguments just because they seem a bit odd to me. So I can't really give you a better answer. I mean, I just...
I'm just wondering, how robust these kind of ideas are, because, you know, the remarkable thing about all these classical arguments is that, despite the fact that they seem to take very different starting points, they all give you exactly the same thing. Whereas in the quantum case, I can't see this. You start from these different approaches, which, different things as fundamental. It seems that I can't think of any reason why you get end up with the same.
I can see what you're saying. In if I didn't use Cox's axioms and use, say, deep Infinity's sort of work, why would I necessarily get to these objects? I think we might. I'm not sure, but
you may be able to. I mean, so talking to several philosophers in probability, usually say, well, at the end of the day, the axioms of probability theory themselves are, you know, more sort of natural and compelling than any of these sort of more supposedly more basic arguments. Like the common compact. I mean, maybe you can argue about, you know, the more measured theoretic things, but at least in the finite case, you know, the idea that you should describe things by numbers that are lots of one is, you know, just a compelling idea on its own. It's sort of a posteriori, we kind of say, we need justification for this. So, you know, but it's in some ways it's sort of clear that it's less, the justifications are all less compelling than the theory itself, by the very fact that, you know, a different statistician comes up with a very different kind of set of axioms.
And gets the same result.
So my worry about this kind of stuff is whether it really carries anywhere.
And it might be problematic, but not sure.
I mean, you didn't say also about this.
You
need to show that there's something that was quite deep in this. And there's a good chance any other approach
would
yield. I mean, it's sort of physical in there.
Guessing enough that naturally appears in quantum theory, and if we really justify why it appears in quantum theory from basic plausible axioms, I think that's a little different.
Well, I mean, okay, so even very phases, you only observe them by statistics,
yeah.
Right? So there's an experiment you can do with an interferometer that will allow you to determine the very phase of such and such a system, but still, it's counting coincidences on detectors that you're actually doing the experiment, and the long-term statistics gives you the very phase, I agree. But it doesn't, and personally to me, it doesn't seem to have as fundamental a role as counting frequency.
Yeah, sure, but I just think that it's quite amazing that just going from
quantum to that. It's nice that it happened,
but it's, yeah. But it's whether you argue is that sufficient to make it for it to be true. I don't know.
It's like arguing, you know, what loss is a probability quantity in the theory. So, you know, in terms of physics, when you're looking at planets, you might take the primitive quantity of observations you need for a telescope. But you might also say that the primitive quantity of the trajectory is vanished around. You could make an argument this
thing
makes some kind of object to the.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, lots of physicists think that, you know, these phases are important, really important physical things about quantum theory. So, I mean, you'll certainly get some people agreeing.
Yeah. Well, certainly, to me, they're experimentally verifiable, so I want to include them in my theory somehow. If I just use relative frequencies and just calculate relative frequencies, they're not put on an equal footing as its phases. And to me, since they're both experimentally verifiable, I should put them on equal footing. And then this seems quite natural because I've got an entity that incorporates them both. I can derive both phases and relative frequencies and phase and probabilities in a real and in a complex manner. So I think it's quite nice.